Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Friday, March the 8th, 2024. If it's Friday, it must be That Was the Week. And if it's That Was the Week, it must be some terrible AI art, which Keith always leads with. Problem with this AI art for people watching, two things, Keith. Firstly, and the subject is a very interesting subject, incumbents under threat, governments, big tech and startups, the inevitable rise of the new. Your photo in it looks is suspiciously young. Have you told the AI to make you look younger?
Actually, that's an overlay on top. That's a real photo taken, I don't know, 2 years ago.
30 years ago, was it?
30, no, but
29 and a half. And the other thing about this AI art, it's got big tech in a Roman amphitheater, and then governments and the EU somehow symbolically situated. The AI has managed to misspell governments. They've spelled it G-O-V-E-R-M-E-N-T-S, which isn't saying much for the spelling of AI.
Well, you know, AI is terrible at words. Have you not noticed that? Whenever it's doing images.
Yeah, that's the headline. AI is terrible at words. So what's it good at?
Actually, it's good at words when you're doing text. It's terrible at putting words into graphics. So the graphic engine doesn't understand words.
So why do you persist with this terrible AI art? Are you trying to undermine AI somehow?
It is. Look, let's firstly just agree it's terrible.
It's your art. I've already said that.
And I did take the first attempt. I was busy. This was like at 9 o'clock last night after I'd written my editorial. So there's no doubt I was lazy and unconcerned about how bad it was, just because it kind of did a half decent job. Do you know what I did, Andrew? Here's the good thing. I gave it my full editorial. And I said, illustrate this. And it came up with that illustration. And it's a fairly decent synthesis of all the different points in the editorial.
Well, maybe it's because your editorial is complicated and interesting. And the AI couldn't manage to take that complicated, interesting editorial and turn it into complicated and interesting vision. Anyway, so... we've done the critique, Keith. Let's focus on the editorial, which is very interesting. You talk in the editorial about there being three dominant players in the world today, the government, startups, and big tech companies. Are they fighting each other?
Well, you'd have to do a three-dimensional grid to show all the fights. Governments are disagreeing with governments. Big tech is resisting government, and government is fighting big tech. But big tech is also fighting big tech. There's interscene wars between them. And then startups are, being described by commentators as unlikely to succeed due to the dominance of big tech on the one hand, yet... they are actually threatened by startups. So there's no single pattern. There's a lot going on. And so the editorial's job really is to disentangle all of that and try to understand it.
So you use this term incumbents under threat. The incumbents are government and big tech, or is it just government that's the incumbent?
The incumbent really describes big tech. It comes from Kyle Harrison's essay, which is the first one in Essays of the Week. It's called
The Age of Incumbents. Distribution plus data become concentration functions.
Yeah.
According to Kyle Harrison. What does that mean?
So he's really talking about the bar for a startup to be even in the game has got super high, and only big companies can afford it. So they concentrate data, computing power, storage, in ways that startups can't approach. That's the thesis. And Kyle's an investor, so he's in a way being quite pessimistic about investing, saying that the chances of success are much smaller because of the power of incumbents.
So are we, and Keith, you and I have talked about this before, and you see everything because you were and you remain an entrepreneur, and you're also an observer of investment. Are the 2020s different, and especially the age of AI, different from the 1990s or even the 2000s, when you could just start something in your garage, in your dorm room, and a la Zuckerberg or Page and Brin, turn your company into a trillion dollar monolith, Leviathan? These days, you need to have a few billion to even start, don't you?
No, you don't. That's the myth. I mean, if you look at some of the very successful AI companies, Perplexity would be a good example. But I think a lot of the open source AI companies as well, you know, there's a lot of relatively cheap, if not free, resources out there to build AI. But you have to focus on applications that generic AI isn't you know, focused on. So OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, they're all focused on artificial general intelligence, and they're investing very large sums, billions. And yes, startups probably can't go there anymore. But most of the money from AI isn't going to be made from the infrastructure any more than it was in the web. The money is made by clever uses of AI on specific problems where it is a solution. So, you know, if I tried to reinvent venture capital, I'd fail. But if I apply AI to scoring venture capital and selecting companies that score high, I can succeed because that's a niche no one else is focused on. So I think it's really all to do with what you focus on.
One of the stories this week is this ongoing feud, which has now hit the courts, between Elon Musk and OpenAI. It's really a feud between, it seems, Musk and Altman, about who stole what from whom. Doesn't that reflect, though, the foundations of OpenAI are also the foundations of big tech? It's not really a startup environment.
It isn't a startup environment if you're looking to build, you know, the future brain that's good at everything. But it is a startup environment if you're looking to apply AI to specific problems. Like Perplexity AI focuses on web search, and that's all.
Which is pretty ambitious. I mean, they're directly going up against Google and everyone over the last 20 years that have tried to challenge Google's dominance in search have failed. So, well, Perplexity, and they just got valued this week at what, $1 billion? So they're not a tiny startup either.
Well, their revenue is only $10 million. I read $10 million. So they're quite small. So they're valued at, you know, a very large percentage of their revenue, and that's because of the promise. And you've been using it, right? I think you told me.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I think it's interesting. You know, I think it definitely offers an alternative to Google. But I'm still not profoundly dissatisfied with Google, I think. So.
Well, it's a different thing. The other thing that came out this week is Anthropic launched the next version of what they call it, Claude 3.
Yeah, I've been playing around with that, but that's they have hundreds of billions of dollars of investment, Anthropic.
They do, but they started as a startup. That's the key. It didn't start in Google or Amazon.
Well, it started in OpenAI, so it's a schismatic company that came out of OpenAI.
Well, the individual started in OpenAI, but OpenAI didn't fund him.
So,
by the way, that's what happens in the Valley. You know a lot of these people, but smart people get together. They sometimes are in the same company, and then new ideas emerge, because every time you push against reality, you open up thinking that didn't exist before, and then new things come out. And the Valley's very good at that. In fact, the Elon Musk thing you pointed to, the fight with Altman, is so contrary to Silicon Valley's normal way of behaving. Normally, Musk and Altman would have a friendly difference of opinion and go their different ways and both build something and, you know, still be somewhat friendly. The fact that Musk is choosing to sue OpenAI, and then OpenAI exposed all of the emails and messages that went between the two of them, which make Musk look really bad, by the way, I think.
If he makes him bad in your eyes, then he must look really bad, because you're one of his few defenders.
He certainly comes out as being completely contrived, not really having any principles, and just trying to get his own way like a spoiled teenager.
Surprise, surprise. You thought otherwise? What did you imagine he was?
Yeah. And, you know, that probably produces the adrenaline that gets him, or the dopamine that gets him motivated for whatever he's doing next. I think he needs that. Ron Conway yesterday published an open letter from his angel investing fund, Silicon Valley Angel, more or less championing the potential of AI and asking everybody to focus on that and not fight each other.
Well, Keith, is what's happening now, this fight over AI, is history just repeating itself? Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, the incumbent was Microsoft. Google was the rebellious company, the disruptor. Is now Perplexity challenging Google? Is Google really just Microsoft and Perplexity, the new Google? Is everything basically just replaying itself?
Well, there's definitely a constant replay in technology, because incumbents almost never survive. And that's why Kyle's Age of Incumbents is interesting.
One could bring up IBM, one could bring up Microsoft. I mean, they've survived.
Microsoft went through a near-death experience, only to survive once it dumped Office and even Windows and moved to the cloud, which was more aligned with the times. And it still is a failure on mobile, and arguably it's a failure on AI.
I think it's now the most. I mean, what is it? A $3 trillion company. So the markets wouldn't agree with you.
Well, the $3 trillion is all about the cloud success, which is merited.
Considerable. But is Google, I mean, one of the other interesting pieces you linked to today in the newsletter is one by David Kifferman and Baum about how Google blew up its open culture and compromised its products. History is repeating itself here in the sense that Google has increasingly become a bureaucratized company, not very spirited, the staff always in rebellion, weak leadership, bad products, basically like Microsoft, isn't it?
It's interesting. Sergey Brin was videoed doing an hour-long talk last Saturday to an internal team working on AI. And honestly, I thought he was great. He was relaxed, thoughtful, honest.
He's not an officer of the company.
But he's not an officer of the company. So I think what this is, it's, you know, the modern version of the fall of the Roman Empire, if you want to talk about history repeating itself. It's aging entities, especially successful aging entities. You could argue the United States is one of those. The leadership get complacent. They fear being unpopular. So they take steps to remain aligned with the public consciousness or the direction of public thought. And they lose any real vision or direction formed from that vision. And I think that's just age. It's age. And
is that why you on the art, you made yourself look younger?
Exactly.
Old people are,
because I'm so
original and not spirited
with how I look, obviously.
So we've got the problem of the startups now challenging incumbents, which had historically been themselves startups. Yeah. What about the role of government? You cite a piece from the New York Times about how tech giants are now being forced to bow to the global onslaught of rules. This is different, isn't it? This didn't really happen, certainly not in the 1990s and probably not in the 2000s.
Yeah, it's really the success of technology in becoming global has led to multiple authorities trying to regulate it. And the opportunity in tech is global. So it would not be smart for a startup to focus only on a single market. The world is your oyster. And so that comes with regulation, because we live in a nation state organized.
And you're a big fan of nation states, Keith, aren't you?
Nation states are
I'm teasing you. I know you don't really like them.
Well, it's not about liking them. They're the status quo organizing principle of the world due to history. They are increasingly also showing their age, because they want to slow everything down and control it. And whenever authority wants to slow things down and control it, the authority usually falls into disrepute. And history is not kind to people who try to slow history down. So I hate nation states. I think nation states will ultimately not survive as the best way for the human race to organize the world.
So say that again, history not kind to people who try to slow things down.
Yeah.
Like the Roman Catholic Church?
Anyone.
Well, they were pretty strong, because one of your arguments in the against government in the editorial is you say government's attempt, and I'm quoting you, government attempts to get technology under control cannot succeed because they do not have global reach. The end result, with many governments all trying to control the new technologies, like the Italians with AI, is inevitable. The historical parallel that comes to mind is the government of Florence trying to hold back the formation of Italy. So that got me thinking about that. And, you know, when you look at the government of Florence lasted between 1115 and 1569, and an independent Italy didn't appear for another 400 years. So there's nothing inevitable about this, is there?
It was way less than 400 years, Andrew. Emmanuel.
No, it wasn't. The Republic of Florence.
No, I'm saying Italy didn't arise in the 1900s.
Yes, it did.
No.
Well, this is not a show on Italian history, but the formation, an Italian nation state appeared, I think, in 1860.
Yeah, exactly, 1860.
Okay, so 500 years after the collapse of Florence. So my point is not to turn this into a debate on Italian history.
But well, yeah.
Two things. But firstly, that it's not inevitable. And secondly, it takes an awful long time.
Well, what?
Yeah,
but that's no crime. And time, things do take time. If you look at the real point I'm making is, prior to nation states, there were organized fiefdoms, cities, feudal territories, often given by kings or queens. And they were resistors to the rise of nation states. Look at the history of Bismarck and Germany. Everywhere. And even now in the modern world, as nation states either break apart or come into being, this tension between human organization at a higher level and the prior smaller human organization is a constant in history.
But sometimes states break up. Yugoslavia, the Soviet Union, they're not always. Spain has been very weak.
There is
the reverse potential as well.
Yeah, only in short historical windows. I mean, the history of the human race is not a history of breaking up into smaller entities at all. But there are times when that happens. The history of the human race is integration on a global scale, led by markets initially.
But aren't we seeing two things? That's certainly true, but also a more and more sort of heightened sensitivity politically to, if not nation states, territories, identities. We have Brexit, yeah. We have the rise of Trump. That we may not like them, but they're realities.
They are, but they're driven by fear and the desire to retain the old. It's really conservatism with a small c is behind identity politics and nation states.
Are incumbents, Keith, always conservative with a small c?
They always become conservative with a small c, always. And they never win, never.
But what about radical politicians who are also incumbents, somebody like Bobby Kennedy?
He's not really a success story, is he, Bobby Kennedy?
Well, he was assassinated, or even JFK. They were part of the establishment, and they tried to push them.
Yeah, it's true, but JFK, it's a bell curve. There's the upward part of the bell curve, and that's what we remember him for. I if you ask me what do I think of JFK, my instinctive answer is he was fantastic. Because of civil rights and all kinds of impressions in my head. But the truth is, there was a bell curve. Him getting assassinated, means he didn't go all the way down the other side of the bell curve. But say Barack Obama did. If you look at his achievements from the start of him being in office to the end, there's a slowing down effect. And I think it's just natural to the human condition that complacency kicks in. It was interesting last night that Biden showed the opposite. Biden showed that he wants to be on the upward side of a new bell curve.
So speaking of Biden, Biden has said, and this very much fits with your editorial this week on incumbents being under threat, Biden said that he would sign the TikTok bill that could ban the app. This is incredibly controversial this week. Congress is plowing forward, according to Axios, even if TikTok users are in revolt, the app's fighting back. Even Trump isn't entirely sure which way to go on TikTok. Is this exhibit A, Keith, in the inability of government to really deal with new technology or companies like TikTok?
Well, it's one of the few examples of globalism coming into the US from outside and the US government fearing it. In most of the world, it's US technology coming in from the outside and other governments trying to slow it down. But it's the same phenomenon. It's things that the human race creates that are bigger than any nation get blocked by nations that it engages with. It's true of Facebook. It's true of Google. It's true of, there's a few companies where it's less true. Microsoft and Apple come to mind. There's a lot of Microsoft software in China, and there's a lot of Apple iPhones in China, because they've learned to navigate this.
But coming back to TikTok and China, given the reality, for better or worse, the new Cold War or the new Great Power conflict is between the US and China, and that's not going to go away for the first half of the 21st century. Isn't the crisis or the clash over TikTok, isn't that inevitable? It's a consequence, and isn't that's not going away?
Yeah,
and so doubt the China. I mean, the Chinese are playing the same game. You can't use Google in China. Apple have bent over backwards to work with the Chinese.
Yeah, actually, Google pulled out of China. They were allowed to be there.
That was our friend Sergey Brin, who, unlike many tech magnates, actually had a crisis of conscience and realized that was the right thing to do.
I think Musk and Apple have it right, which is as long as nations exist, if you want to do business on their territory, you're going to have to comply with their laws. That's just a fact. It is absolutely stupid that there are hundreds of laws that a global startup has to comply with, and that's the irrational piece. I do think, the truth is, TikTok is not a threat to anybody in the US. TikTok is not controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. TikTok is not full of spies. It's all BS. But, people believe it. And I would guess they will not end up doing anything to TikTok, just like they didn't the last two times this arose as an issue. it's all pre November.
Well, all I can say is if we use your Italy model, we're not going to get your united government until about 25-24, which, Keith, I don't think even you will be around then, will you?
Well, I'm not trying to be practical. I'm trying to predict the future. And the future can happen a long time from now. And certainly there's no part of me that thinks it will happen quickly.
Well,
but
the thing with these future scenarios is if you plan far enough and something, it will all happen. It's like correcting the, you know, it's like predicting the time on a clock that's stopped. Anyway, we'll come back to this. Do you have something to say?
I was just going to say one thing, Andrew, which is my main goal is to sensitize intellect into understanding that nation states are consciously trying to slow down the emergence of a new history. And whether or not we end up getting rid of nation states or not is not really the point. It's understanding nation states as a constraining factor on human experience.
How would you have responded at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century to the trust busters, to the people trying to regulate not big tech then, but big oil or big railroads? Would you have made the same argument? Because that was successful and that benefited the American economy in the long run.
I generally favor regulation. You know, when the people through democracy try to protect themselves from profit gougers like pharmaceutical companies today, I'm all in favor of it. But when governments try to slow down progress, I'm not in favor of it.
Well, we will come back to this. Keith, you were critical of Elon Musk, which shocks me, but perhaps because you made one of his companies, a certain company called X, formerly known as Twitter, your startup of the week. What have X done this week to justify this huge reward? I think they're going to announce it at the Oscars tomorrow, aren't they?
So X finally has shipped its long-form writing platform. You have to be paying them $16 a month to use it. But after that, it's free.
This is different from the... Because I pay them something for a blue tick. Is this different?
Yeah, it's one step up from the blue tick. You'll see it in your Twitter options. If you open up Twitter on the web, you'll see there's some options. And one of them, I think it's called Twitter Premium or something like that. You also get...
Yeah, I was trying to sell me on something when I go there.
But this is a long form.
And you're a big fan of Substack. Isn't Twitter or X just trying to become Substack when it grows up?
It's replicated a lot of Substack's features. I'm going to use it today. After we finish and this video gets edited, I'm going to create both a Substack and a Twitter version of the newsletter and see the impact. We'll talk about
it. I hope you're not going to edit out the stuff on Italy.
No, it's definitely not going to edit.
It doesn't get edited. You and I don't have time for edits, do we?
Well, we add, we add, what I do is I don't know if you realize this, Andrew, but I remove the whole keen on bit. And I replace it with the...
You're big media. You're like the government. You're like a nation state, Keith.
I changed the cover.
You're an editorial. You're an authoritarian.
I am.
Oh, my God. I don't know if I'm going to do this anymore. So is this, but in all seriousness, Keith, is this just more flailing, more Musk throwing spaghetti at the wall, trying to figure out what X is going to become? It sounds rather unimaginative. The whole point of X was it was a short message platform. Why do they want to be a long message platform?
Well, I think he wants to be the public square, as he calls it. And I think, you know,
want to be the public square. Big deal.
So in line with, the history of Greece, he doesn't think the public square is only for short form outbursts, but he thinks it should be long form as well. So you can go into depth and educate people. I think it's okay. And, he does have...
Is anyone going to use it except for you and I? Is anyone going to pay $14 to publish on X when you can do it for free on Substack?
Well, Substack takes 10% of any money you make. So you end up paying Substack more if you're successful. I think it's fine. And I think it is a startup. I mean, the very fact that you're questioning it tells us there's a lot of open-endedness as to whether it succeeds or not. So it is a startup. And because it has 300 million readers, it's kind of interesting to start publishing on it just to see what happens.
So what can't you do currently without this? You can do long form, can't you? Are there limits to how much you can
publish? Yeah, no, there's limits. You can only do 280 characters if you don't pay. You can do some long form if you do pay. But if you're premium, you can embed videos, long videos like
ours. I do embedding videos.
No, those are live, but you can actually embed videos by uploading them and putting them in, just like you would at, say, YouTube.
Well, I'm not convinced that he can bring X or whatever he wants to call it back from the dead. But one thing that has come back from the dead, which astonished me, but probably not you, and this is your X of the week, is Bitcoin. I thought that one was dead. How come they've gone back up, Keith?
It's been a long process. I mean, Bitcoin was last at this price, I think it was probably 2016 or 17, something like that. So it's been a long journey back. It went down as low as $3,000, I think, in the interim.
Is it all speculation, though? Are speculators driving it up and they're all going to sell again?
You know, Mark Cuban was interviewed at the White House this week, and his answer was that he considers it the best store of value on the planet. So like all stores of value, they rely on people being prepared to store their money in them. So it's confidence-based. And given that BlackRock and many others have recently been allowed to launch these ETFs on the NASDAQ, which are Bitcoin-only ETFs, it seems as if the crowd that has confidence in Bitcoin has grown to include lots of very conservative incumbents in the finance space. So it's probably more immune to speculation than it used to be.
How much does it have to grow before another crash would actually impact the bigger economy, the broader economy?
I don't particularly think that they're correlated. I think Bitcoin's a bit like gold in that it has its own cadence based on whether people want to put money into it as a safe place to put it. There are many people predicting that it will double in what remains of this year, from this price to about 150,000.
Well, we'll see by the end of the year. And what context is it a hedge against the US government, the dollar, and old men like Donald Trump and Joe Biden?
Yeah, well, you know, that could be a long answer, but the short answer is, starting with COVID, the number of dollars that were printed reduced the real value of a dollar by about 30%. So a dollar note today can buy 30% less than it could before COVID due to printing money.
It makes me feel better because I don't have any savings.
So when money is losing value due to government printing, people who can tend to look to put their money into assets that don't decline in value, like property, artwork, gold. Bitcoin is one, something that will appreciate. And I think Bitcoin is a theoretical store because the only thing that makes it valuable is that people choose to use it.
I think there's a bigger story here. I don't quite know how it's going to work out, but I'm guessing that we again, like all these other stories, we're not at the end of it, maybe just the beginning. Would you put your money, Keith, into Bitcoin or long form articles on X? Would you spend your $16 on Twitter monthly or buy $16 worth of Bitcoin?
No, I have not held any Bitcoin for about 5 years, and I'm not planning to buy any now. But that's just because I have the luxury of being in fairly stable investments that make it possible for me to retire at some point in my life. And I don't want to threaten that. But I think younger people, I'd be inclined to say put 10% of your money into Bitcoin.